been me gone in front of his home. When they did, the group was wrong. Who's the wrong? Gotta hold on, gotta stay strong. When it did come, better believe on, gotta show that you can lean on.
Welcome back. This is Lester Spence. Man, that is a wonderful, wonderful track. Bone Thugs Harmony laying it down. I know they've got to be celebrating because the Cleveland Cavaliers just won their first championship, bringing, I think, the first championship to Cleveland in approximately, I think, more than 50 years. So for Father's Day, I was blessed with tickets to go see the DC Jazz Fest. And I mean, it was a wonderful day. The final act was Kamasi Washington. The only thing with Kamasi Washington, by the way, he has an album, a trip album that's actually wonderful. It totally expanded or given me, renewed my hope in jazz. I mean, it's absolutely wonderful. It's got like a 70s vibe to it. That's really, really wonderful. Anyway, his set starts at 8 o'clock. We're supposed to start at 8 o'clock. Only one thing, like the set actually starts at the same time the game does. So I finally, for folks who know me, I've got a cell phone for the first time in like a last cell phone I had was the iPhone 3GS, right? So it was the first time I've got like a real up-to-date smartphone, and I've got this little Wi-Fi unit that gives me extra data. So I'm actually streaming the game while I'm listening to Kamasi Washington, right? And, you know, Kamasi Washington says awesome. He ends it at 10 o'clock right on time, and we sprint to watch the game. Me and my kids end up sprinting to watch the game. We end up watching the last few minutes of the game with Robbie Coltrane, who was there also at the Jazz Fest, some of Kamasi's band, and a group of other folks. I cannot remember a game seven that was as exciting. And I like Golden State enough, but I really wanted Cleveland to win because I wanted LeBron to get his third championship, right? So there are all types of politics embedded in this, you know, that we could talk about strictly from the standpoint of basketball, whether it's LeBron versus LeBron and the type of player he represents, to Stephen Curry, who I think is a new type of player. We can talk about the teams, Golden State versus Cleveland. We can talk about, to the extent that people have talked about, written about politics. Michael Dyson, I think, wrote a piece focusing on Team Lightskin. Like, a lot of folk have been talking about the fact that both starting guards for Golden State are incredibly light. I mean, so light that Team Lightskin has become a hashtag. And the joke is that they're both bringing Lightskin back, like single-handedly bringing Lightskin back, versus LeBron James's more dark-skinned youth, right? Those politics are interesting, but with the basketball is a multi-billion dollar industry. And I thought it'd be interesting and more important to talk about the finals, not just to talk about the finals and the sports dynamic, but to also talk about the development aspects of it, right? So for those of you who don't know, Stephen Curry, he used to have a shoe deal with Nike. He now has a shoe deal with Under Armour, and he's not quite single-handedly, but almost single-handedly made Under Armour the second most profitable sports apparel business in the country after Nike, probably the third most in the world after Nike and Adidas. And of course, the Under Armour is owned by, or the CEO of Under Armour is Kevin Plank, who has a really interesting relationship with Baltimore, particularly given the Port Covington stuff. And then the Cleveland Cavaliers are actually owned by Dan Gilbert. Dan Gilbert's the owner of Quicken Loans. Dan Gilbert, for those of you who are not aware, actually lives outside of Detroit and spends a significant amount of time in Detroit. He's bought so many buildings in downtown, approximately 82 at the last count, that some people actually now call it Gilbertville. So what I wanted to do is kind of talk through these political dynamics, kind of connecting them to sports. Along with me now, on the show with me now is Rachel Cohen. She actually wrote a really insightful piece about Port Covington for Slate Magazine that I think just came out yesterday. And then later, hopefully, we'll get in David Leonard. David Leonard is a professor at Washington State University and author of After Our Test, the MBA and the Assault on Blackness. And he's also author of the forthcoming Playing While White, Privilege and Power on and Off the Field. Rachel, are you with us?
Yeah, hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. So David's here with us? Oh, excellent. David, are you here too?
I am here, Lester.
Oh,
how you doing?
Excellent. What's up? How are you doing, man? Congratulations on not being chair anymore, by the way.
Thank you. We got 9 days.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. 9 days. I'm counting them down. So, Rachel, why don't you do me a favor? We've actually had a number of shows about Port Covington already, but do me a favor. Tell them about the article you just wrote for Slate.
Sure. The article that there's been a lot of really good coverage sort of here and there over the past couple months. I tried to sort of put a bunch of the concerns all in one piece. So there's concerns about, you know, whether or not this is actually meaningful affordable housing because they want to use the, you know, regional AMI instead of the city's AMI. There's concerns about how it's going to impact school funding. There's concerns about whether these are actually good jobs. There's a lot of rhetoric about if a TIF is a subsidy or not. Sagamore, the developer, has made a lot of effort to tell people, you know, it's not a tax break, it's not a subsidy, it's just a loan. But of course, it's a subsidy. TIFs, unlike other sort of municipal loan tools, are repaid with tax funds that would have otherwise gone to the city's general coffers. In other situations, a private company might take out a loan, and then they are responsible for paying back the loan with their money. With the case of TIFs, it's the public that pays back the loan. The piece basically, I talked to Sagamore, I asked them questions like, why are you pushing this forward so quickly? Like, what's the rush? Why? Because a lot of the public that's concerned say, you know, why with something that's this consequential for Baltimore's economic development for decades, why would we approve it, you know, in just a couple of weeks? And I talked to, you know, different people who have sort of concerns about various aspects of the deal as it's currently, you know, proposed.
It was an excellent, excellent, excellent piece, and thank you for writing it. David, could you chime? So how tie this into the growth of Stephen Curry's a brand, if you could.
So I think Steph represents this, as you said, a new paradigm, not only in terms of the style of play, the three-pointer, but an ongoing shift, and we see this throughout the history of the NBA in terms of the racial politics of the league. He writes, as Bomani Jones describes, the humble superstar who can talk trash, who can be exuberant, who can exhibit a level of excitement, a level of in your face, but still be imagined as humble. And as you note, that people have connected that to skin color. We can connect it to his professed religiosity, the way that the narrative has been framed around him as this, someone who's pulled himself up by his bootstraps, who've been the underdog. I mean, it's striking to imagine a player as an underdog who is the seventh pick in the draft,
right.
Who grew up,
yeah.
The son of a of an NBA player who had access to any number of resources, yet he's this story that's juxtaposed against someone like LeBron James. And so you get all these different dynamics, you know, whether it's the lack of visible tattoos, and Under Armour, I think, like many of our apparel, is selling a particular lifestyle, a particular cultural place, and youthfulness is one of them. Going against those established brands is another. And so Stephen Curry becomes the perfect pitch man for what they're selling.
So what we're going to do is we're going to follow up on this right after the break. Don't go away. On our way to break, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.meq.com. Welcome back. This is Lester Spence. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're talking NBA finals, sports development, and Port Covington. I'm joined by Professor David Leonard, Professor of Washington State University, and Rachel Cohen, a journalist who just published an excellent article in Slate.com on the proposed Port Covington project. Now, David, before the break, you talked a little bit about Stephen Curry. Flip that and talk a little bit about LeBron James and kind of what he represents, what bringing a title to Cleveland represents for the city.
Well, LeBron represents a lot, and I think he represents different things to different people. And I think it's important to really lay out those stakes because LeBron, you know, while cultivating his own brand that emphasizes really his multiple identities as basketball player, as father, as husband, as businessman, as global icon, he also has emphasized his rise from Akron. So that's important. But I think he represents someone who has successfully branded himself as authentic, as someone who has, despite his exit to Miami, who's stayed connected to Akron when he talks about his favorite city in the world. This man says Akron, and I think that goes a long way. But your question about what the championship means for Cleveland, and you know, as a Lakers fan, I remember championships a long time ago. and I understand the symbolic value. I understand the way it taps into nostalgia. And of course, I don't understand what it is to go 52 years without any championship. But I also think we have to reflect on, as you did in your piece and Rachel did in hers, of the way that symbolic value is sold at other costs. You know, that championship, what Dan Gilbert has done in Cleveland and Detroit, what when we look at other owners, that hasn't addressed poverty rates in Cleveland, which as of 2012, half of Cleveland's children grew up in poverty. And so when we look at stadium subsidies, when we look at the impact of sports stadiums as it relates to gentrification, we have to keep the symbolic value in conversation with the material consequences.
So, and for the listeners, I actually wrote a piece on this myself called The Other Game 7. It's at Jacobin. I think it's jacobin.com or maybe jacobin.org, or just Google Jacobin and my name and the piece will come up. And I basically talk about the NBA Finals, a little bit about Port Covington, and then a lot on Detroit. Dan Gilbert, he's not only bought 82 buildings in downtown Detroit, he's established a 500 camera surveillance network in the city, and also basically has his own private police force. So again, it's something the state, that type of development project where you've got two individuals in Dan Gilbert and Kevin Plank basically significantly rebuilding downtown have to be kind of taken into account when dealing with the symbolic stuff. Rachel, I'm curious, as a journalist, how did you think about this, or did you think about this when you were writing your piece?
About the NBA Finals?
Yes.
I was thinking about Steph Curry as one of the, in relationship to Under Armour, yeah, because with Under Armour has been doing so well as a company, and there's this sort of assumption. There's this assumption that if the city doesn't give Sagamore everything it's asking for, then the successful company is going to go somewhere else. And they don't even have to say anything, and they didn't say anything. But that was sort of everyone said it for them. Like they can just sort of be quiet and sit back, and everyone's like, "Well, we, you know, they're a good company, and we need to do everything to make this as, you know, attractive as possible for them." Yeah, I was thinking about sort of how sort of neat and tidy everything was working out in sort of the political debate for, like, rather than say, you know, if we're going to, rather than say, it's actually really expensive for businesses to pick up and leave, and what other jurisdiction is even going to give Under Armour everything they're asking for, no questions asked, rather than say, you know, we'll consider giving you this tip as long as we get, you know, X, Y, Z, A, B, C, things negotiated beforehand. There's just been so many people being like, well, why do you oppose development, or don't you care about jobs? You know, with no sort of nuance about whether they're good jobs or who would fill the jobs. And I think that Sagamore itself has made a big effort to say the TIF would go to infrastructure and not to Under Armour. But I think it's really important to recognize that Kevin Plank owns Sagamore and he owns Under Armour, and we should be thinking about these two things together, even if they want us to not think about them together.
So for listeners, Sagamore is the real estate development company of Kevin Plank. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Yeah, now, and it's really interesting. The more I think about this, right? So it'd be one thing if for example, Kevin Plank owned the Ravens, right? And then it'd be another thing if Dan Gilbert owned, say, the Detroit Pistons, right? Because in that case, you can at least understand kind of the symbolic thing, or rather, going back to Dan Gilbert, a better example. Let's say Dan Gilbert didn't own most of the buildings in downtown Detroit. He owned most of the buildings in downtown Cleveland, right? And he was a Cleveland guy. That actually would kind of – you could actually make the symbolic argument more, right? You can say, well, you know what? This guy is giving us – he's given us a lot. We haven't had a championship in 54 years. And it's funny because speaking as a Detroiter, I've seen championships now, but – like, if the Lions were to win a championship and they haven't won one since 57, I don't know what I'd do, right? You can imagine. I can get that symbolic thing. But we're actually not talking about the work that that Dan Gilbert is doing in Detroit. It doesn't have anything to do with Detroit sports teams. The work that Kevin Plank is doing in Baltimore doesn't have anything to do with Baltimore sports teams. Yet and still – it's like they're still getting these sweetheart or getting these sweetheart deals that basically give them the city with little to nothing in return. There's actually, you know, real quick, we've got a caller. Leo in Baltimore wants to talk about this, and then I'll shoot right back to you, David. Leo, are you there?
Yes, good morning, my friends. Is this Lester Spence?
That's what they tell me.
Yeah, and Rachel Cohen and everybody. Well, yeah. I'm the chairperson of the Committee of Concerned Citizens and also president founder of Roots of Scouting Incorporated. Let me just say that I just feel oppressed. I feel like we're being victimized. I'm a native Baltimorean and a community organizer, and I'm 74 years old, and I know when we're being screwed, so to speak, and it just seems that I knew nothing about this until 5 months ago when it came on the television. Yeah. These ads from Port Covington and the underpinning of Under Armour, the group that subsidizes Under Armour, its front group, whose name escapes me at this moment. But I'm simply saying that what are the benefits to our community? There is something called the Community Benefits Agreement, which is inclusive, is required in all TIFs. This is the great granddaddy of all TIFs, $660 million and still counting. What, in terms of apprenticeship programs for black people, for poor people, what are we talking about in terms of numbers for Cherry Hill and Mount Winans, Westport, Sandtown, and Winchester communities? The demographics of Baltimore City that represent concentrated poverty and an underclass that can't get away from violence and drugs because there are no jobs here. What can we hold Kevin Plank and Under Armour hostage in terms of being part of the programming, the money source for year-round jobs for our youth and apprenticeship programs that will ensure that we're going to have 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people who now have potential but no jobs, that they will have jobs in the construction phase of Port Covington. And that's not being talked about to the extent that we'd like to see it. And that's all I want to say. The Greater Baltimore Committee and Donald Fry, the president, he's the face of that, obviously is involved in steamrolling this over everyone in this city. The Baltimore Development Corporation, Bill Cole, and his alliance with Elijah Cummings, you know, this was cut and dried, and the community was never consulted prior to its coming on board, so to speak. So again, this is rammed down our throats. And who's going to rescue us? Or is it coming from the NAACP or the Urban League? Urban League is coming here in August for its national convention. Should we not be boycotting the convention centers here? Is that our only recourse to boycott ass businesses and fraternities and sororities and stay out of Baltimore until we, the citizenry, get justice? We don't want violence, but violence is being perpetrated upon us by the powers that be. The political establishment, the Democratic political machine, and to some extent the governor as well as the mayor, they're asleep at the switch or they're co-conspirators. What are we going to do about this? Let's talk about the nuts and bolts of fairness and justice in job creation and the survival of our city, aside from it being a gentrified model for the nation.
Oh, thanks a lot, Lee. I appreciate it. Rachel, what are some of the things that Port Covington is offering, or or Sagamore is offering in exchange for the TIF?
I think sort of a big disagreement right now is how much should be negotiated before the TIF is approved versus after. So I know the Baltimore Brew, which has been doing really good reporting, you know, people were bringing up, topics related to community benefits agreements and other sorts of things. And from my understanding, a lot of these issues have not, like, they're just sort of tabling them for now. Like, there is no, the profit sharing aspect, which will likely be part of it, like, that's not settled. And they're trying to sort of compartmentalize a lot of these negotiations, whereas I think activists want it to be, all together. And the developer wants it approved, in August, so they can sort of get started right away. I think that's where we're going to see a lot of the, to answer your question specifically, for example, they say, we're going to voluntarily make a goal of having 10% of our residential units be affordable. And at first, their TIF application said it would be 7,000 units. Now it's nearly 14,000. But they define affordability as, not affordable for, if you're a resident of Baltimore right now, they use the median income. So that's like that's the type of thing that I think activists want to negotiate and hammer out before a TIF deal is approved, whereas, they are sort of avoiding that right now.
David, I got you, but I wanted you. Blah, 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 blah. Can you do that on radio? I've got you. I want to ask you a question about the longer history of this type of stuff. But we've actually got another caller. James from Baltimore, are you there?
A certain interest in program. I'm 81 years old, seventh grade education. I was the first black to own a cab association in the state of Maryland in 78 years. Nobody knows about it. I couldn't get anybody to support me. But what's happening down around the water, because money likes water, they're just going back to where it started 150 years ago. They started the world at the water. They worked their way up. And now they're in a position of pushing us where they left, like they always do. And they're going to make everything beautiful there. But we never come to the table and say, we are doing this, even if it's the smallest thing. That's the beginning. It's easy to go to the bank and get an expansion loan than it is to get a loan to build something. If you're always asking for something and you have nothing to bring to the table, no idea of what you want, if you don't know what you want, you don't know the outcome you want, how are you going to get it?
Thanks a lot, James. Both those callers are really, they really came at an appropriate moment, because both of them, are older than 65, both are past retirement age. And that kind of, and James's question about it, or James kind of pointing out that 150-year history, gets to the historical question. David, what's the, is what we're looking at with Dan Gilbert and Kevin Plank, are they anomalies, or what's the longer history of this stuff?
They're definitely not anomalies. And if you look at any number of sports franchises, we've seen not only the public subsidies of stadium construction, we've seen the gentrification of communities. I mean, you look at the transformation of downtown Los Angeles around the Staples Center that people will celebrate with all not only things like LA Live and construction of restaurants. People will celebrate like, look, downtown Los Angeles has been revitalized. And then the next question is for whom? At what cost in terms of housing, in terms of longstanding communities? If you look at Seattle and the effects of their stadium construction on the International District, if you look at New Jersey and the Barclays Center, and you see a similar history, you see promises of jobs, and all the social science research demonstrates that all of those promises are without truth, without fulfillment. You see promises of affordable housing, which gets with each year changes in terms of what is affordable, in terms of what kind of housing. You see threats of teams leaving and then giveaways. And ultimately, that investment in the symbolic trumps everything else. And in this case, the numbers don't lie. As of 2003, in the Big Four sports, there have been $23.8 billion spent on sports facilities, and 64% was provided by the public. And so when we look at the values of these teams, which is really where the money is, you know, people like to talk about year-to-year profit, but when teams are worth $2 and $3 and $4 billion, much of that comes from the value and the increased visibility and the communal importance of the stadium. And as you know, this has a 20-30 year history, and it continues. We're seeing it right now in Los Angeles with the return of football, which are using the same sort of narratives in terms of jobs, in terms of communal importance, and we know that how that history has worked out, particularly for communities of color. Is that throughout American cities?
Is that new LA stadium? Is that built with public money or private money?
I don't know the split. I can check.
Yeah.
But even when it's private money, we know all the different subsidies, all the different tax breaks that are part of the deal anyway. So the notion of public private split and even the way that land use is done, or as you noted, the way in which policing happens around stadiums or in stadiums, who has access to the privatized space. And so when you look at all of these stadiums from Barclays to even what you're talking about in Baltimore, it's this push for self-containing communities that are only accessible to a small portion of the city. That are policed, that are inaccessible both because of the policing and the cost. Or you look at the stadiums, when you have a Warriors ticket that goes for $49,000.
Yeah, really? Oh, wow, yeah, really, yeah.
We're talking about public good?
Yeah.
And so ultimately, we're creating spaces that are privatized and only available for a small segment within what used to be the public square.
So as Rachel notes, or as Rachel implies in her piece, there's pushback. There have been people doing activist work against Port Covington since the deal became public. In Detroit, there's been some activist work against Dan Gilbert. And as an aside, even in Detroit, Dan Gilbert's not an anomaly. They're building a new stadium for the Detroit Red Wings. Even as Detroit was bankrupt, the state agreed to finance, I think there is more than 50%, if not more, of that new stadium, which is at least a few hundred million dollars, is going to be provided for by public resources.
$283 million for that new new ice rink.
Yes, for that new, and I'm a Red Wings fan. I mean, black people in Detroit actually do watch hockey. So, I mean, I get that local nationalist sentiment, right? I mean, that there's nothing like the Lakers kind of give L.A. something, as sprawling as L.A. is, and L.A. is incredibly sprawling, right? The Lakers basically gave people on each side of that sprawling city something to share and say, okay, we're in the same group, right? In the Red Wings case, as the NHL began to expand to warmer cities like Phoenix, Dallas, and whatnot, you also often have more Red Wings fans at those games than you would Phoenix Coyote fans or Dallas Star fans, right? So there's something to it. But at the same time, we have to keep in mind that as long as we're talking about capitalist entities, as long as we're talking about capitalist enterprise, we're talking about capital. And in as much as all these stadiums are built in metropolitan areas with limited land, we're talking about all types of development politics, land politics, and economic politics. So I can really be happy, incredibly happy, for LeBron James for winning his championship number 3. In my personal estimation, this makes him like top 5 all time. I can also be happy about Golden State's 73-win season and happy for the success of somebody like Stephen Curry, Draymond Green, Michigan State represent, and Klay Thompson, right? But while I can be happy about those, it's really important that we keep an eye on capital and how that moves. So on that note, I really want to thank Rachel Cohen, a journalist who just published her article in Slate. Is really, really helpful here. Thank you so much, Rachel. I really appreciate the work you do. We're proud of you at Hopkins. I also want to thank David Leonard, professor at Washington State University. The work you do is incredibly important, and in 9 days, you'll be able to get back to it. I appreciate you.
Likewise, Lester.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have to take a brief break. Don't go away. When we come back, we'll talk about an event coming up about Islamophobia.